Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen, where we're continuing our series of the Lord of the Rings extended edition films. And depending on how I cut these up, I'm not sure what number this is, but this is the first of the Two Towers episodes. And I'm just going to jump right in. If you want to catch up to where we are, you can go back and listen to the Fellowship of the Ring in terms of where we are in the background in the film. And we're going to start with this podcast right into the Two Towers Extended Edition film. So here we go. So we rejoin our story after the credits at the Bridge of Khazad Dûm. And this time we fall with Gandalf and the Balrog. And it's a spectacular opening sequence. The camera now swirls in and around and down and follows Gandalf as he falls with the Balrog. It's an unbelievable sequence. I mean, to take the imaginative fall from the books and to have it be this, you know, the way they shot it, you know, Gandalf catches up first to his sword and you hear it hit his palm and then he continues on down and they're just battling back and forth and there's fire and smoke and flame. And then there's one moment, which one of my favorites. You're way back looking over this dark, cavernous cave, and the Balrog and Gandalf just start falling into the space from the top, and the light from the Balrog illuminates the cave. And oh, it's biblical, man, as it's supposed to be. Really a spectacular moment. And then as they kind of rush down to the bottom of that cavern, we see that it's a giant lake that's there, and we cut immediately to Frodo and Sam, and actually Frodo has been dreaming this. They are climbing over the rocks and crags of Emimule, which is, if you know your Middle-earth map, just north of the Dead Marshes. And after they have gotten down from a certain height, they lament that they, you know, can't bring the elvish rope that Sam got from Galadriel with them. And of course, he tugs on it. And just like the book, the rope, the knot magically unties and comes falling down, which I liked. We're starting to talk now about the ring and its effects on Frodo, and that escalates during this film as he gets closer to Mordor, and we talk about the ring is getting heavier to carry the closer he gets. And then we have this sequence where they capture Gollum, which is pretty awesome. They know he's coming at night, and when he gets close to them, they grab him and knock him down and capture him. Just an aside, I think in these kind of large movies, in any kind of, you know, movie of this type, really, this is the first successful, fully CGI character that I've ever seen. The antecedent to Gollum is Jar Jar Binks, and we all know how successful that was. So it's really an astonishing thing, especially when they've got the elvish rope on him, and he's walking behind them in the Emimule, and it's sort of the, you know, his gray skin and the gray rocks around him. It looks so incredibly lifelike. He's a CGI character, right? So it's never completely 100%, but it's about as close as I've ever seen. I mean, and even here now, in 2016, when I've seen the Hobbit movies, I think Gollum is a more successful CGI character than the Azog. And, you know, Jackson had years of technology on himself when he did Gollum to doing Azog later on. Just an incredible triumph. And actually, as you get through these movies, you realize that Gollum is actually the most complex character in the entire story. Mad props have to go to Andy Serkis, who kind of started the industry. I don't know how much they've recognized it yet, but he really has started the trend on recognizing actors for their work at green screen and motion capture and that kind of thing. It depends how many of these movies come out each year for the Academy to actually create a motion capture award of some kind. But he did a tremendous, tremendous job over the latter two movies of this series. And what I think is impressive, too, is that you're able really, especially later on in this film, you're able to get at the duality of Gollum. There is a wretchedness about him that is very pitiable, you know, like, and he's also cunning and incredibly evil at the same time. And they're able to bring this across in film, which is, to me, astonishing and a triumph, because that's the way the book portrays Gollum. And there are so many passages where characters pity, even Sam near the end at Mount Doom in the book actually pities Gollum, even after all of his treachery, you know. So they really do, I think they bring this off in the film and showing us at times just kind of how wretched and destroyed he's been by the ring, and how pitiable that is. And at the same time, you know, what a cunning, evil bastard he is as well. So very complicated, and I think they bring it off really well. But so what begins here is Gollum, the character, pretty much goes from beginning to end, right? But there's a resurgence of Sméagol, which begins at the beginning of this movie and kind of ends at the beginning of Return of the King, where the pity of Frodo kind of reanimates this character, the part of him that was, you know, long dead and long been taken over sort of by the evil Gollum side. And I'll get a little bit more about that as we go. So we, a lot of cross-cutting in this film. I think one of the great things about these movies in general is the novelty that continues to pop up frame after frame. In Fellowship, you pretty much were with the main group all the time. But beginning in Two Towers and going through the end of the film, you know, you're cross-cutting like in the book, back and forth. Although in the book, the large chunks of story are sort of, you know, you do the large chunk of Two Towers story about, you know, Saruman and Helm's Deep, you know, as a one long half of a book. And then the second half of the book is the entire Frodo-Sam story. You know, you're not getting that kind of continuous cutback that you get in, say, something like War and Peace. But Jackson puts them together, which I think, of course, is very smart. So you're constantly shifting and moving and seeing new and brilliant things, which I think allows Two Towers to kind of pick up the pace a little bit and just be a really, really fun watch. So now we shift to the Uruk-hai as they force march through Gondor and they meet up with the Mordor orcs. Right away, we can see on screen the different shapes of the two different orcs. The Mordor orcs are elves that have been twisted and mutilated into this lower form, and the Saruman orcs of the White Hand are those orcs crossed with men. So they're definitely two distinct breeds. And the Uruks are just larger. They have throatier growls, whereas the Mordor orcs are a little more slimy and creepy, a little more cunning in a weird way. So I think they do the two different styles of orcs really well on the screen. You can tell right off who's who, which I think is genius. I mean, easy enough for you to not do that and just have it be like, it's orcs meeting orcs, whatever. But, you know, that Jackson actually and his team read closely into the book and recognized the two different types of orcs, and they bring it off on screen. Just, you know, one of the many times when I'm watching this film when I'm just so jazzed at how deeply they went into the books to bring things off. There's that brief moment where Pippin dumps off his little the little leaf clasp of his cloak, which will be picked up later by Aragorn and team. So we see that happen. And then we shift to Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas as they are giving chase. And we get one of our gorgeous, you know, long helicopter shots showing the larger landscape around them as they're running straight on in pursuit. Just gorgeous, as they always are. And we hear that they have now entered the Kingdom of Rohan, a land of the Horse Lords. So, you know, for the lay audience, you know, we get a little name check of where they are. And we then cut to Orthanc and Saruman, and we see Saruman using a palantir and getting some instructions from his boss in Barad-dûr. And we get a full pan-up shot. The camera pans up on Barad-dûr, and we just see how incredibly black and imposing and nasty it looks. It's a wonderful piece of production design. They're felling more trees around Orthanc, and this time, you know, they're getting closer to Fangorn, which we'll find out later. We see more Uruks being born out of those creepy, you know, stretch pods and all filled with viscous fluids and just incredibly gross. And now we see a bit of a subplot. Saruman gets the hill tribes to declare allegiance and directs them to start their rampage over the Rohan's villages. One bit of this is we see a woman and her children. She puts the children on a horse, sends them away, and she remains to face the hillmen who are now, you know, burning half of the village. And we're going to see these kids pop up a little bit later. Now, I believe this is an extended-only scene. We're introduced to Éomer. Instead of being introduced to Éomer as he comes upon Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli. We see him come across Theodred, fallen in battle against some orcs, and he's near death but not dead yet. And Carl Urban is just so great as Eomer. I knew nothing of Carl Urban before this film, and I've seen a bunch of stuff he's been in afterwards, and I don't think he's ever topped Eomer. Maybe Scotty in the Star Trek movies, which is a great role of his, but he's wonderful as Eomer, or Eomer, as it were. Then we get a brief tease of Edoras. We visit the throne room and we meet Eowyn. And basically we come upon Theoden as he's basically mummified by Saruman's sorcery and the oily Grima worm tongue, played by the always awesome Brad Dourif, who just is a scene stealer here. He's so good. I mean, you know, when we got to Two Towers and all these new characters started to pop up, I thought, man, you know, is there any bad casting in this entire series? Like, as these new roles appear, they're just filled with these wonderful actors that you've never heard of. I think most of them are either from New Zealand or Australia, that part of the world. Bernard Lee as Theoden is just fantastic, and you know, steals up, you know, as an amazingly imposing figure on the screen. The woman playing Eowyn is terrific. You know, Urban is great. There's not like and Dourif playing Grima. Just, you know, I don't know if there's a false note in casting. I mean, you could argue in some ways that Sean Astin as Sam is kind of ridiculous because his accent is really all over the place. But the earnestness with which he brings across his character, to me, kind of makes up for what sketchiness might be about Astin's performance. So anyway, just made me think here of how well cast this film really was. And the little bit we do get here is that Eomer is exiled for understanding, really, Grima's purpose in the kingdom. And so he's completely exiled, and we see a writ that's been signed earlier by Theoden, of course, you know, coerced into it by Grima. But that sets up Eomer's exile and eventually, you know, his Han Solo-like return later in the movie. So we resume the chase now. Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn and the Uruk-hai. There's some great Hilo shots over the orc band and our heroes and, you know, our Howard Shore soundtrack cue as they hoof it across Rohan. And then at night, the Mordor orcs are exhausted because they're not as strong as the Saruman orcs. And they have a camp at the borders of Fanghorn Forest, and they start a fire and make camp there. And there's a wonderfully, again, and you're going to get tired of me saying it, but a wonderful horror movie moment as they keep the part of Tolkien's book where they're arguing about eating the hobbits, which I think is awesome. You know, what about their legs? They don't need those. And the orcs arguing about it are really gross looking. Really, the makeup here for the orcs is so great because they're in the screen, no CGI. They're real actors with just wonderful makeup, but they look very otherworldly and non-human. And then there's a brief battle as a Mordor orc tries to get at Merry and Pippin, and the Saruman orc blocks him and lops off his head. And this is a great line. Looks like meat's back on the menu, boys. And so the only orcs gruesomely attack and eat their fellow orc, and we see, as if it was a George Romero zombie movie, you know, internal organs being thrown up in the air as they devour the film. And I just thought, horror movie director, and it works really great. At this point, one of the orcs grabs Merry and Pippin, and he's about to skewer them when Eomer's band attacks. And during the battle, things happen, and then we cut away before we see exactly what has happened to them. And now we shift to, I believe, this in the theatrical version, when we meet Eomer proper, although we may have met him back at Arras. I'm not exactly sure now. I haven't seen the theatrical versions in a long time. There's a wonderful moment when Eomer turns the horses around and Aragorn stands up and greetings, riders from Rohan, you know, and they all lower their lances and surround our three heroes. Wonderfully choreographed horse scene. And the horse stunt work in this film is really great, really wonderful. And I love that Jackson relies on it and does a lot of work with real hostlers, I believe is they're called, and it's just really great to see. And I also love the helms, the helmets that the Rohan soldiers wear, these conical helmets, and running down the center and then forming a nose guard is the mane, the neck, and the head of a horse. And it's also has tails on it. The helmet has these sort of, as if they were a horse's mane on their helmet. It's just a triumph of production design. Really cool looking. So they have this great back and forth where, you know, they kind of become friends. After an initial standoff between Gimli and Eomer, they kind of make up and realize they're all on the same side. And Eomer gives them two horses, Arad and Hasufel, which I can't believe I remember their names. And they trade information about what's going on in the land, and then his band takes off. But the heavy information that our heroes get is that the band of orcs they've been tracking has been obliterated. And there's a pyre that's been, you know, burning for a few hours now. And they assume that the hobbits are dead. So now we cut straight to that burning mound. And another wonderful horror director moment is as the camera is panning over to look at the pyre of burning orcs, in the foreground is an orc head on a pike with its tongue sticking out, quite dead. It's just genius. Just another great visceral moment where you're like, this is not a Disney movie, and I'm constantly being reminded of how horrible the servants of the enemy are right in my face. So really brilliant. And so Aragorn does his ranger tracking we hear Gimli say we failed them, and there's this moment where they're taking in the fact that the hobbits are in fact dead. And then Aragorn has this moment where he tracks them away from the fight. And the way he does it made me think of the Princess Bride, Fritz Humperdinck. Someone has beaten a giant, you know, when he does it ridiculous tracking, and you know, he reconstructs the sword fight and everything that's going on as he's tracking the heroes of that film. And just the energy was very similar as Aragorn was tracking it. And what I like they do here is they cross-cut Aragorn and our heroes tracking them into the forest with what actually happened the night before. So, you know, one thing about epic films that sometimes can be difficult is they get caught up into like a stately kind of filming where, you know, everything's kind of stately and big, and you know, you're constantly in this tone and pacing of like a big film, and there are times when it can get quite boring. And then you have stuff like this where Jackson's still trying to do stuff with narrative, and even a simple cutback like this where you're cutting back from more heroes to what happened the night before, it just adds visually and rhythmically to what's going on, and it takes you out of the fact that you're in a big-ass movie, and it makes it's continually novel and fun, which I think is why, again, these movies work so well. So part of then what we see the night before is the introduction of Treebeard, and I just think Treebeard is a triumph of art direction. I love Treebeard's face. I love the whole thing. I think it came from, again, a John Howard, Alan Lee painting, and it's wonderful how it starts. I think Pippin is clinging to a tree, and when Merry is almost getting killed by the orc, the eyes open. And you didn't know it was a face until the eyes open, and then you recognize that it's actually Treebeard. Again, very novel, very brilliant, very tricky how it's introduced. And I like that they stick to the book in terms of the speech pattern. It speaks very slow. We hear it say like, harum, you know, all these things that were written out phonetically in the book. They really hewed close to it, and I think it really works on screen, which is wonderful. And the design of Treebeard as kind of a tree-like creature, it's just great, beautiful. And the sound design and the Foley work, you know, as it moves around and grabs things and stalks through the forest, really well done. And so, you know, we leave it as it's carrying our two hobbits towards the White Wizard. And we've heard some scuttlebutt earlier that Saruman has been known to walk about as a wizard cloaked in white. And so, you know, we're being led to this red herring of that Saruman is in league with the Ents, and that Treebeard is actually a bad character. If you are not familiar with the books and you're seeing this for the first time, you know, you don't know. So, interesting. And the scene ends with them being thrown to the ground and looking up, and we see this sort of hem of a white cloak, and out we go. So now we cut back to Frodo and Sam, and they're entering the dead marshes. And yet again, sorry to annoy you with this continual diatribe of mine, but the horror movie element. As they're walking past these marshes, we see these dead faces just under the water. Elves and men that have died. I think it was the last alliance of men and elves, but they're still preserved from the old battles. And there's this wonderful moment where Frodo's walking and he's looking at a dead elf, and the eyes pop open, and they're all white. I mean, it's just creepy, you know, like, here we are again in a big budget fantasy movie, and we're constantly being hit by these horror movie devices. Just so great. And he goes in the water underneath, and all these ghosts of the dead beings there are coming at him. Just wonderful, and then pulled out by Gollum, which is terrific. So later that night, we sort of is the creation of sort of the Smeagol personality, which exists pretty much for this movie and a little bit of the next, but where Frodo somehow knows his name was Smeagol, and I don't think we have seen the scene where he was told that name, so we're not sure how he learned it, but you know, it's this wonderful discussion about how you were not so unlike a hobbit once. And, you know, what I like about this is I don't get this so much in the book, although it's there. But Frodo really needs to believe that Gollum can come back because he's headed down the same road. And I just think it's a wonderful, I think you really get that in the film. You really understand that part of his rehabilitation of Gollum is like, you know, for himself, for his own sake. If Gollum can be brought back to some degree, then possibly he can too, you know, because he's feeling the pull mile by mile. Then we get the escalation now of the Black Riders from horses to dragons. And it's a great trick moment where if you don't know the novels and you're watching this film, when they said, oh, we hear the Black Riders hide, they shoot the Black Rider as if he's riding, you know, some kind of steed, which if you don't know the books, you would assume is a horse. And then the camera pulls back and it's on this beautiful black dragon, which is just astonishing. And what's so great here is the sound design of the wings. They really thought about this. A creature that large, flapping wings of that size, you would hear this woof sound. And it's every time the Black Riders are in the frame in any of these latter two movies, you hear that sound. And it's just a great sound effect. And at the same time, you're seeing that their nearness is really throwing Frodo, I think in the book they call it the Black Breath. When they're near, the ring kind of is pulled towards them pretty powerfully and affects Frodo even more. And we see that on screen. We cut away from this back to Fangorn Forest, and we get a little bit of background about the Ents from Legolas, who explains to Gimli that the elves began the process of what they call waking up the trees. And so it's cool to kind of get a little Ent backstory. Then we get the return of Gandalf, which is wonderful. And, of course, they think it's Saruman. The voice that, you know, when they turn to strike at this white figure, all of their weapons are, you know, knocked out of their hands and the arrows get tossed aside. And we hear the voice of Christopher Lee then blending into the voice of Ian McKellen. And boom, it's Gandalf the White. A great return moment. And then we pick up the fight of the Balrog right at the end where they're on this really high promontory. And Gandalf hits it with one last sword stroke, and it falls down dead. And, of course, he is dead as well. Like, if you read the book, too, it's Gandalf did die during that fight. They grabbed a line from the book, which is so powerful in the movie. I smote his ruin upon the mountainside. He says it. McKellen says it like a Shakespearean line. It's so beautiful. And then we get a bit of Gandalf's ethereal journeys after death. A little bit of 2001, you know, Stargate-ish stuff. That he was sent back. So a little bit of mysticism, a little bit of spirituality, that his task is not complete. We then meet Shadowfax soon after, and they keep the names from the book. So again, I love the effect of these names as they're spoken in the screen. They've kept all the original names that Tolkien came up with, and they allowed the audience to sort of get hit with this unfamiliar sound as they're spoken. But they're beautiful names. Tolkien really was influenced heavily by Old English. You know, he really has a flair for naming things, and they kept it. And I think it's very powerful. So Shadowfax, first of all, the name, what a wonderful name. And he's one of the Meras, which is, I guess, you know, these elevated horses, which are, and he's the lord of all horses. So beautiful. Again, it's the novelty of this film that we're continually introduced to new landscapes, new beings, new magic, you know, the Ents, Shadowfax, the return of Gandalf, the marshes, all this, you know, and it's boom, 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 boom. It's, you know, one after the other. We move through these films in an incredible way. So from here, we cut to the Black Gate, which is a pretty astonishing visual. And what I love about this is the scene where, you know, Frodo is going to go through and Gollum holds him back and says, there's a better way. You're pretty much going to get busted if you walk in this way. But they've worked out the engineering about how the gates open, and they show you, which is just, for me, fascinating. I mean, engineering of any kind of structure like that is just kind of a fascinating thing for me personally. But there are two trolls on each side, and you see when the whip is cracked, they walk along these semicircular pathways, moving these extremely long shafts. Sort of the back half of the shaft is what's connected to the trolls, and the front half of the shaft is actually part of the gate itself. And you see how the gates open. It's not, you know, they could have just done the gates opening, right? And no one would have really blinked. But the fact that they went in and thought about, like, how would you engineer gates of this size to open? And you see it happen. I just really like that. There's also a great little visual trick in that Sam falls down as this troop of Southron, you know, men are going into the to Mordor, he creates a little stir and two of the men come close to look. And Frodo sort of saves him by finding him and then pulling his elvish cloak over them. And when the camera pulls back from behind the two men looking around, you just see this rock. You don't really know what it is. And then when they leave from underneath this, what looks like a rock, it's actually the elvish cloak. And in the books, it's exactly, you know, these cloaks are kind of magical in that they become camouflage. And so it's just, I thought it was a very subtle but clever way of showing that. And now we get the narrative information about Gollum knowing the alternative way in and Sam not wanting to trust him and Frodo having to put his trust in him. And now mostly calling him Smeagol and not Gollum. So there's been a shift there as well. And so, you know, the reclamation of his character continues. So we cut back to Merry and Pippin drinking Entwash, and there's a brief moment where, you know, Merry realizes that Pippin's growing taller. Pippin doesn't want him to know it, so it's a bit of comic relief, which is very fun. And then they're trapped by this tree that has begun to woke up, and Treebeard has to free them from it. And what I loved about this is that, what is the forest? When you think about fantasy movies and kids' movies, what does the forest conjure up, right? It's like a, oh, we're in the forest, it's a wonderful place, and trees, and this, the Ent Forest, Fangorn, is an angry, dangerous place where the hobbits are not really safe unless they're with Treebeard, because the trees are waking up really pissed off, and they'll kill them. And I just really was taken aback by that, you know, the second or third time I watched it. Like, wow, you know, this is a dangerous place to be. This is not fun walking in the forest with the fun tree guy. I mean, you could just imagine how the whole Treebeard thing might have gone with some misguided director thinking that it should do an ecological thing. Like, oh, the tree should be wise and beautiful and it should be friendly and elevated and all this stuff. And they're slow. They take forever to do anything. So they're frustratingly slow and a bit stodgy and really angry. Like, what a weird combination that is. So just, you know, I need to point that out. And we do get a bit of the Ent wives, which is such a sad little tale. We hear a bit of it in the book as well, that there are no more Entings because they've lost the Ent wives. So they ostensibly cannot mate to produce new Ents. Kind of a sad thing. Very mythological, very, you know, Tolkien. So we cut from here to Edoras, which is sort of the capital of Rohan, and our three heroes visiting. And the whole production design of Edoras is really beautiful. It's done sort of like those Celtic, I think they're called Kells. And it's consistent throughout the designs of, you know, what the inlaid carvings on the pillars and all of the tapestries that are there. Very much made me think of Hero, which is the big hall of Hrothgar in the Beowulf poem, that this is very much done. It's like a mix of Viking and sort of Celtic heraldry imagery, call it what you will, but really beautifully designed down to the cups they use and the wonderful horse armor. And the main hall, Edoras, which is at the top of this wonderful hill, you know, these streets that wind up to the top. And I think they really built at least the out part of this, the outer part, they really built it. Because you get the classic Peter Jackson helicopter bird's eye view shot of it, and it is gorgeous. Now we get a brief scene between Eowyn and Grima, and Theodred has just died, and Brad Dourif is at his creepy best. And there's kind of a Richard III wooing moment here, where in her grief that Grima really is kind of revealing how much in love and sweet he is with her. And some of it's really effective. I think this is Brad Dourif's wonderful moment in this film that he does this. And she, of course, rebuffs him. And when she storms outside, we see in the distance our three heroes approaching. And at the gate, they're met by Hema, who unfortunately meets his end not too far afterwards at the hands of the wargs. But the actor playing Hema is just wonderful. And it meets them at the gate. And of course, they have to give up their weapons, but Gandalf gets to keep his walking stick. And inside the hall, we get more wonderful production design, and we get the wonderful Gandalf battling Saruman through Theoden. And it's a creepy laugh at first coming from Theoden, the king, and then it's mixed with Christopher Lee's voice as he threatens Gandalf, if, you know, you push me out of him, the king will die. But Gandalf triumphs, and we cut briefly back to Orthanc, and we see Saruman has been sort of blasted off his feet and he's bleeding from the nose a bit. So we sense from here, at the very least, that Gandalf is now much more powerful than he used to be. And there's a wonderful transformation from Theoden as we had seen him up till now, this kind of mummified, white-haired, white-skinned man. And he kind of transforms into the actor Bernard Hill, who's just really wonderful. I can't say enough about Bernard Hill as Theoden. Just really anchors so much of this middle film. You know, and I got to give it to the filmmakers, too, that they allowed such strong actors to be on the screen along with the principals, you know, trusting to everybody that would just gel, and they didn't have to, like, you know, prop up the lead actors by having lesser characters around them. It just, in a sense, when there's byplay between Aragorn and Theoden all the time, and it brings Aragorn up even further, I think, in the audience estimation, because we're bowled over by Bernard Hill straight away of like, wow, what an august, this guy's a king and no mistake. And then we see Aragorn sort of rise into the beginning of his own like king-like behavior as a result of being around this guy. And later on during Helm's Deep, Aragorn sort of emerges as the guiding spirit near the end of the battle. So again, casting, can't say enough about it. So we have the sort of downfall of Grima. Wormtongue, as Theoden comes out and he's about to kill him, and Aragorn saves Grima from Theoden's sword. In the novel, it's more complicated, and I think it's done a little bit better, in that they play around with mercy again, which mercy is something that's it comes up so often in Tolkien's novel, because, you know, he purposely is treating that theme, mercy and pity and these other, you know, Christian virtues that he's treating on. So in the novel, that Theoden gives Grima a chance to redeem himself and says, listen, you have two choices. You know, you can take a horse and leave, but you never be seen again and never, you know, next time we meet, I would possibly kill you if I could. Or you can fight by my side and show me your courage and your loyalty. The mercy of Grima makes Grima spit at Theoden because he's so shamed by it because his character is so worthless that there's no way he would do that. And it's a similar thing that happens in the Scouring of the Shire, which did not make the film. When Frodo doesn't kill Saruman at the end of the novel, he treats him with mercy. And Saruman recognizes how badly he's been beaten, you know, that you've shown the advanced trait of mercy, and now I must go forever in your debt, you know. And so it's a theme that Tolkien hews very close to, but not so much in the movie. But, you know, they do spare him. So that is, you know, some of it has made it to the film, and that they do spare his life, and they, you know, it's not the taking of lives. It's not so callous here that it's sort of woven into the film a bit. It's just not as, I think, powerful as Tolkien did it. Then a really beautiful, solemn moment as Theoden's son, is interred into the cairn of the burial mounds of his forefathers. And they give Theoden a real moment to cry. And Bernard Hill is tremendous here. And he just weeps that, you know, a father should never have to bury his son. And some of the things that Gandalf says to me are a little too stodgy and a little too epic movie BS. But there's a moment when Gandalf stops talking and he just allows Theoden to grieve. And the film allows the grief to happen and allows this moment to be. I don't think it made the theatrical cut, but it keeps the film grounded in real things. Like, you know, he's the king and, yeah, they kind of won. They beat Saruman and, you know, they beat off Wormtongue. But he lost his son, you know, and it was not without cost. So right at that moment, the horse bearing the two children that were sent off by their mother earlier comes, and there's a bit of a council now where they find out that the hill tribes are burning the villages and the war is kind of upon Rohan, and they all sit in council, and everyone, you know, our heroes want Theoden to march out and meet the armies head on, and Theoden decides that, you know, the thing for me to do is to save my people and go to Helm's Deep. And I like that, you know, the Aragorn and all of them are like, they're trying to tell him what to do, and he won't. And he's like, I'm the king. And so there's a nice rub here where even though they're all, you know, our heroes, they don't all see the eye to eye. And Theoden is kind of stubborn about what he wants to do. And it's not all like hunky-dory, like, hey, let's all go to Helm's Deep. Great. Like, there's a bit of a rift. And even Gandalf is sort of like miffed that he won't go. But he goes anyway. So I kind of like that they did that. Gandalf parts from everyone here. It happens later on in the book. He goes almost all the way to Helm's Deep with them before he bails. But he's, you know, setting up the rescue later on. He sets out for help. In the book, Éomer is with them to Helm's Deep, and he fights at Helm's Deep. And it's Erkenbrand who is out fighting in the sort of, you know, far away. And when Gandalf shows up later on, it's with Erkenbrand and his troop to save the day, not Éomer. But again, I think they were very smart in combining them and making Éomer sort of the hero, because having Éomer fight at Helm's Deep is just another character you have to track, and it's not necessarily important because Éomer doesn't really have an arc. He's just a doughy fighter that we like. You don't have much to do with him, so why not make him the one who comes to save the day? So again, you know, every time there's a little divergence from the book, I always respect Jackson's choice. I very rarely do I come across something where, You know, he went afield of the book in a way that doesn't do the book justice. He's so ridiculously sure-footed from time to time as he makes these changes that just incredible.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, $4 a month, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi on Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys, and I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/sci-fi-on-screen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
No, blah, blah, blah.
So then we are really introduced to Eowyn for the first time. And she's a, you know, I got to give Tolkien credit, like to have a female warrior. She turns out to be a warrior. And in a sense, a feminist figure in the book that she's, you know, told to always take care of the women and children and not allowed to fight. And she finally shows her brilliance by taking down the Witch King of Angmar, who's, you know, like second to Sauron in power, if you think about it. Pretty astounding. So they meet here for the first time, and she's doing some forms with a sword. She looks great. Miranda Otto, I believe, is the actress' name. She's really fantastic. She's a fighter, and there's a wonderful monologue of hers that, you know, she fears a cage, and in Aragorn, very generously, is like, you know, that will not be your fate. You're a shield maiden of Rohan. A very generous, you know, thing of sort of supporting her character. And she, you know, feels it. You can see, you know, this is the beginning of a very brief, I think just on her side, awakening of some feelings between the two. Although, obviously, Aragorn is committed to Arwen. But as we will come to find out soon, he has forcibly parted from her. Then we get a brief montage, you know, which you have to do in big budget films, I guess, like this, and showing the massive exodus from Edoras as everyone heads to Helm's Deep. We got more Helo shots, and we really get a sense of where they're going and what the landscape is like. And also then we see Saruman sending out his warg, W-A-R-G, riders, which are the giant wolf riders. I think we got some of this in The Hobbit, I believe, but this is the first appearance of the wargs, I believe, in Lord of the Rings. But before we can join them, we flip back to Frodo, Sam, and Gollum. And we start a bit of a rift where Frodo kind of takes it to Sam for running Gollum down all the time. Because Sam really knows what Gollum is. In a sense, Sam is correct in that, you know, this character will always revert to his darker side when push comes to shove. And Frodo doesn't want to believe that. So he's kind of getting on Sam's case for treating him the way Sam believes he really is. Frodo doesn't want to see him for what he is. He wants to believe that this new Sméagol that he is kind of creating is really the true self. So it's a nice kind of subtle thing in the film where we see the triangle, the relationship triangle between the three get a little murky. And then there's this incredible monologue between Sméagol and Gollum. You know, basically, we see the split sides of his personality, and now we see the ascendance of the Sméagol side. The camera shifts, it starts shifting subtly from side to side as each voice in each comes out of the Gollum character until we're doing a full cutback as if they were two characters speaking to each other. It's very subtle and very effective, and I think it's, you know, he's an incredibly complex character, and we see him banish the Gollum character for that moment where he tells him to go away, that, you know, Sméagol now has a master to trust. He doesn't have to rely on himself and all of the nasty things that he has learned how to do to get by. He can rely on, you know, kind of a higher power, as it were. In a sense, you know, a very small scale. You can read it as a little bit of a religious theme in that he's relying on something else besides himself to get through to the world. And so, you know, the base parts of his character are not necessarily needed all the time to get him through. He has master now, you know, but it's such a tentative new thing that, of course, you know, not meant to last. But it underlines, and I have to reiterate that Gollum is the most complex character in this film. Even though Frodo does change over time, like, to me, that the CGI character and Andy Serkis is the most interesting and complex character in this entire trilogy. Now our party stumbles into a bit of a skirmish on the edges of the wild in Gondor. And we see that it's men of the South. Ring's readers were Harad, I believe, Far Harad. The men of Harad, the cruel Haradrim, I think is how Tolkien puts it, are coming up in force heading to Mordor. And we get our first glimpse of these giant war elephants, which we will see quite extensively in Return of the King. And during this little skirmish, we get the reveal of the Gondorians. And they're sort of like cloaked and hooded, sort of like Robin Hood, you know, Men of the West, as it were. But we're introduced to Faramir, played by this guy David Wenham, who's really terrific in this. And they're caught. And there's a wonderful speech from Faramir before they are taken back to, I think, what the book calls Window on the West, this lair that they have in these caves. But I thought that this speech by Faramir, he sees a man from Harad who's dead lying on the ground, and he looks at him, and it's not any kind of triumphant war, you know, type of warmongering or like, we will defeat these evil, blah, blah, blah. I think this, we rarely get this kind of equivocation about war in films like this, right? In these good versus evil, big tentpole movies. It's really amazing. So the brief speech is, quote, "The enemy, his sense of duty was no less than yours, I deem. You wonder what his name is, where he came from, and if he really was evil at heart. What lies or threats led him on this long march from home, if you would not rather have stayed there in peace? War will make corpses of us all," end quote. I thought, I don't remember that in Tolkien at all. Maybe it was in some ephemera that he had written, but man, to throw a little, you know, obviously they're all out against the orcs and the bad guys and against Sauron, you know, as the good versus evil dialectic here. But like, man, to throw kind of an anti-war speech in the middle of this movie, I just thought was brilliant, you know? So now we cut back to our folks over in Rohan who are moving towards Helm's Deep. And we get a chunk of drama that was not in the book, which is sort of the Aragorn fake death kind of thing. And there's some comedy with Gimli about dwarf women, which is kind of funny. Falls from his horse. And now we get a sense, really, in the second film especially, that Gimli is sort of shouldering the comic relief. Now, we don't really have much in the way of comic relief in this film, especially not in the, you know, Sam a little bit on their side of things, and Gollum in a weird way. But, you know, in the Aragorn sort of Rohan side of things, not much. So Gimli's kind of doing most of the comedic work, as it were. And sometimes it works, sometimes it's a bit much. And we get a little bit of Eowyn's backstory here. This is the funny moment where she, you know, she's cooking and she gives Aragorn the stew that she's made and it's really bad and he has to kind of swallow it down. And we find out that Aragorn is like 80-something years old or 90-something years old, really, really old. And that the men of, and this goes back to Tolkien, the Numenoreans, sort of the men of Western Ess, don't age like normal human beings. They're not sort of regular men. You know, they're like these step above. And so they live these extraordinarily long lives. And that Aragorn rode to battle with Eowyn's grandfather, which is, I think, Thengel, something like that. But really cool. So he's actually 87 years old, he says. And now we do a bit of a flashback between him and Arwen at Rivendell, and we get a little bit of this backstory. I think some of this might be in the appendix of some of the material. But there's a bit of Elrond pushing Aragorn to let Arwen go because, you know, Elrond realizes that, you know, if Arwen cleaves herself to him, that she will renounce the long life of her people and die, you know, not maybe soon, but she will eventually die. Whereas the elves, once they kind of move to the Blessed Lands, as they're called, they're immortal. You know, they're going to live forever. And you need to do something with the Arwen-Aragorn thing. I mean, you really do, like, because it's in this, the main part of the book, she's basically a plaything, you know, she's basically there to become the queen eventually. And so I like that they make her a warrior, they replace Glorfindel's part with her, and now they play this up a little bit more about the, you know, the struggle between the father, which is great. So I think this is very well done in that way. And Aragorn is affected by it, so we now get a sense that that look on her face earlier in Fellowship, that he had severed ties with her and he wanted to give her back this little sort of angel token that she had given him. But she said, you know, this is a gift, keep it. But that he said, you know, go with your people, we're done, basically. So I like that. We skip a little bit further and now we're going to have this warg battle, which I don't believe was in the book either. And Hema, who's, I think, the gatekeeper, who I really like, the actor, something about the hangdog common soldier vibe of Hema. He buys it. The warg kind of just bites him right in half. And there's this warg attack, and we get a bit of now Legolas's sort of skill. he does a cool swing up on the horse that he shares with Gimli. The only thing is, in the bright light of day, the wargs are a bit too CGI. You know, a lot of the battles that are fought, especially the one coming at Helm's Deep, are at night, and the main battle, you know, they're fought like under clouds or under darkness, and this is kind of like a bright daylight battle, and the wargs are just a little too fake for me. But, so they lay in this Aragorn false death subplot, which, whatever, you know, there's so many subplots and so much story here, I can't tell if unconsciously this false death subplot works in the film to give it a little extra drama. That would have been just kind of maybe boring plotting exposition as they move towards Helm Deep, or whether it's not needed. It's in a weird way, like sometimes I feel like things work in stories that you're not consciously aware of, but the writers are very smart and that they know, you know, sometimes writers know they need something. They need an emotional sort of downbeat or ghost note, as it were, somewhere, or some kind of little drama to push things along a little bit, because otherwise it would be too straight. And that might be the case here. I'm not sure, but it's like, whatever, you know, the false death, and we all know it, you know, who the hell thinks he's going to die? And so really everything in the movie, we're just waiting, and there's this kind of false drama and false grief. And but anyway, he's swept off the cliff by a warg. The orc that relates his death to Gimli is great, because he's basically, Aragorn's fighting this orc, and in fighting the orc gets thrown off the warg, and Aragorn is dragged over the side. And the orc is half dying, it's coughing up blood, and so they, you know, they come up to it to kind of find out what happened, and it's really gruesome, you know, very much good makeup, good special effects in the frame, as it were. But the orc has Arwen's pendant in his fist, which kind of seals the deal, so he is gone. And then we cut to the arrival at Helm's Deep, and we get a great bird's eye view of the layout of Helm's Deep, the drama of Eowyn hearing of Aragorn's death, and we see the small culvert. Now we get a voiceover of Wormtongue and Saruman talking about some battle strategies, and we focus in on this small little culvert, which is the only weakness in the wall, which allows the stream to pass through underneath. And now we see Saruman, who's preparing an explosive device, which, you know, we can all recognize as being gunpowder, which is pretty awesome. I mean, I've read these books over and over and over again, and at some point, it's briefly kind of mentioned that, that Saruman uses this special fire to bring the walls down, and I kind of never put it together that it was the beginnings of sort of gunpowder. So I don't know. I mean, maybe longtime readers are like, duh, dude, it was always there, and that's fine. When I saw it, I was like, oh, yes, brilliant. Like, yeah, he's a sorcerer, but they didn't make it, you know what I mean? They didn't make it, like, magical. They didn't make it like Saruman is going to give him a special magic potion to place onto the walls. Like, they made it gunpowder. And there's something about that that is very subtle, but I think is very good and very smart choice in the movie, because it keeps it grounded. Like, you don't, you know, Saruman has done enough magic. Everything doesn't need to be magic. Part of his genius, in a sense, his magic is his early modernity in terms of industry and things of that nature. So the fact that this is gunpowder, except, and not some sort of magic potion that he's going to give. And yet it is a magic potion, right? To kind of a Middle Ages technology world, gunpowder is kind of a magic potion. So I don't know, just very, very well thought out, I thought. And then after this brief discussion with Wormtongue, he walks out onto this platform, and we see this massive army of like 10,000 orcs, which is really epic, and we hear them shouting, and he does his basic speech, and off they go. We cut back to Fangor now with Treebeard, and there's some shots with Treebeard that aren't great. You know, when he's walking, the background looks very fake, so some of these shots were not so well integrated, where you can really tell the CGI Treebeard versus, you know, what's going on in the background. So not so awesome, but it's a brief cutaway. I think they're on their way to the Ent Moot, which is something sort of the Ent Council, and the hobbits are going. And then we cut to Aragorn, who's basically, you know, been washed up on a shore, and a ghost version of Arwen visits him. And I never really get a sense if he was okay here or he was dead and she revived him. But the horse Brego, who I guess he was riding, at some point I thought he had let Brego go. It revives him and allows him to, you know, pull himself up over his back. And then we cut back to Rivendell, and we finish up sort of the Arwen story, and Elrond gives Arwen a vision of the future between her and Aragorn, and that, you know, when he dies, she's just going to be linger on alone in her autumn years, all by herself and being lonely, no children. And it really makes her cry, you know, like in sorrow. And he's really kind of putting it on her that, like, you don't want this kind of life, and, you know, you need to come with us. It's a beautiful scene. And again, you know, fleshes out the very thin drama in the book between Aragorn and Arwen, and just makes it more and more, you know, makes her a very full-fledged character and gives the story dramatic stakes. So then we cut back to Faramir's, you know, cool little windows on the West Cave, and Frodo drops Boromir's name. We hear this brief thing of, you know, I was a friend for Boromir from my part, right? A little bit of a hint of what had gone on. So there's a flashback scene now, and they do some brother rivalry between Faramir and Boromir, which I don't remember if it was in the book at all. And I think it was a really kind of smart thing. I guess what they needed here was Faramir to have a little bit of dramatic stakes, because, you know, he has to choose whether or not to keep the ring. And in the book, it's not much of a thing. He just kind of realizes that the, you know, the ring is something that he should let Frodo have. And there's not much hemming and hawing in the book, but they drag it out here in the movie, and they build it up a little bit of this wanting to please his father and wanting to be, you know, always being kind of shat on by Denethor. And so we see that, and then we see this wonderful scene with Sean Bean, you know, where they've just recaptured Osgiliath, and, you know, the Denethor arrives, and he's like, you know, championing Boromir and basically just withering at Faramir, like kind of wants him dead in a weird way. What's nice is about Boromir's characters, Boromir sees it and he pushes back. He's like, you know what, he loves you, he's just an idiot. This is sort of pre-Boromir leaving for the council. Denethor kind of comes to Boromir and he says, you know, they're calling this council in Rivendell, and he tells him about the ring, and John Noble is great. Wonderful casting of Denethor. We get a bit more of him in Return of the King, obviously, but another magnificent choice. Just another august, older actor who commands the screen, you know. We see Boromir actually ride off for Rivendell. But again, a nice dramatic embellishment and giving Faramir a struggle that if he brings his father the ring, man, it's instant paternal love that he's been craving all this time. But the right thing to do, kind of what he knows in his heart, is to let it go. And that tug of war between him, which is not played up in the book very much. So, you know, being a movie and having to kind of push things a bit, I think it was, again, another instinctively smart choice by the writers. Then, of course, there's the scene of the Forbidden Pool where they, you know, they're observing Gollum in the pool, and they have to kind of, they force Frodo into revealing that that they're, you know, that he knows this creature and that they're friends. What's great about this is we see as an audience member how this triggers the reemergence of the Gollum personality, which has been kind of banished for a bit. Technically, Frodo lied and tricked him into being, and they kind of beat on him a little bit too. Like, he's thrown around a lot and beaten on to get to talk. And in the same scene, Faramir now comes to understand that Frodo has the Ring of Power. And of course, because of this backstory that they've added, his eyes light up, and it's like a chance of Faramir of Gondor to show his quality, you know, which is just, I think, a line that his father said, or that Boromir said something. This was kind of a repeated line in the film. Soon after that, now, there is this call for reinforcements as the Gondorians are being attacked on another front, and so off they go. So then we cut back to Rohan, and we see Aragorn as he sees the army of 10,000 headed for Helm's Deep. And of course, there's a great movie moment of Aragorn's reappearance. He pushes open the doors, you know, he enters as the, you know, he's the return of the king, as it were, right? And delivers the news of an army of 10,000 to Theoden, which is, Theoden's kind of like blown away. In a sense, they now walk around Helm's Deep to sort of take in things. And there's a great moment now between Aragorn and Theoden. And again, they do this, you know, in a lot of movies, right? And you have the star of the movie. And ostensibly, Aragorn is the star of, you know, the Lord of the Rings. It's Frodo and Aragorn, right? He's going to be the king and all that. And usually, you know, in movies, like, we have to see how great they are in every bloody scene they're in. Like, everything they do is great. They have this great wisdom. In this scene between Aragorn and Theoden, Aragorn's kind of getting schooled in how to be a king, because Aragorn's basically going to Theoden like, this is no ragtag army. This is 10,000 Uruk-hai. Like, we're dead. And Theoden kind of turns on him, and it's like, hey, man, if this is an end, then we're going to make every bit of heroic end as we can. And it's Theoden now who's like the grizzled king, who's like, what do you want me to do? Like, I have to retain my kingly mien, you know, towards these people and rouse them up to fight as best they can. And Bernard Hale just owns it. I mean, he just owns it. He's so great. And Aragorn kind of, you know, he's kind of schooled a little bit. And like, if this is what's going to happen when you're going to be a king, man, you've got to lead people, even if there's seemingly no hope, which is awesome. So I like that. And then we cut back to Fanghorn and we witness Entmoot, which is called, which is basically, you know, the meeting of the Ents. And we see different sizes and shapes of Ents, different weird, old, grizzled, and strange tree-like faces. Very beautiful, wonderful design. they really scored with the Ents. I thought whenever I watched the Ents on screen, I just really felt comfortable. Like, yeah, it is kind of a tree creature. If they were the first before trees, like you could see how trees evolved from the Ents and how tree-ish they are as well. So really, really great design. Then we cut back to Helm's Deep. Everyone's preparing for battle. Eowyn sort of, is pissed off that she's being sent with the women and children back in the deeper part of the keep. And she kind of declares her love for Aragorn in a hot minute. So we kind of get that, we get that sense of like a little love triangle action going here. There's a wonderful moment, a pre-battle moment, which is great. They don't do the heroic speech, right? They save that for the end of Return of the King when Aragorn kind of has to do it in front of the Black Gates. And it's brief and it's solid and it really works. And, I could just see an easy cliche movie out for them, Theoden, to do a full-on, battle thing. And, of course, they're outnumbered, right? So you could just imagine the cliche nature of such a speech of, like, before the battle speeches, man, unless you're Henry V, like, most of these things, they're just wooden and stiff and kind of lame. So instead, he's so blown away by what's facing them that he's being armed by his armorer. I think it's Gambling, who's arming him. So he's just standing there being armed, and we hear him in voiceover reciting this beautiful poem, which takes place much earlier in the book. In the actual book, Two Towers doesn't take place at this moment. So Aragorn actually recites it in the book. Aragorn is reciting the poem as they are approaching Edoras for the first time with Legolas, Gimli, and Gandalf. But here, I think it was so wonderful. They use it as a pre-battle lament, which is beautiful. And they cut it a bit, but I wanted to read it because I think it's a beautiful little poem. And I mean, how many fantasy authors have tried doing, poetry and verse in their work, and it's universally abysmal. And yet Tolkien is wonderful at it because of his, he's a linguist and a lover and an adorer of language in general. And so he's great at poetry, and especially this kind of archaic style poetry. Here's the poem. It's quote: "Where now the horse and the rider? Where is the horn that was blowing? Where is the helm and the hauberk and the bright hair flowing? Where is the hand on the harp string and the red fire glowing? Where is the spring and the harvest and the tall corn growing? They have passed like rain on the mountain, like a wind in the meadow. The days have gone into the west behind the hills into shadow. Who shall gather the smoke of the dead wood burning or behold the flowing years from the sea returning?" End quote. I mean, gorgeous. And I think they cut it where the last line is "west behind the hills into shadow," which is, for the impending army coming, is just really smart. So beautiful that they used a part of the book in a different spot, and it really is a pungent moment. So now night is swiftly falling, the gates are being manned, and everyone's prepping for battle. And we see Aragorn give this little speech. There's a young kid he's just too young for battle. You can see it. His armor's a little big. And he's looking at this sword that he's got, and the sword's completely pitted, and it's going to crack at the first use. Aragorn says, "Come here, boy." He's like, "This is a good sword." And basically just, very simply, the kid's like, they're saying we won't last the night. And Aragorn picks up the sword, swings it around. It's like, "This is a good sword," and hands it back to him, which is great. And then a little pre-battle comedy from Gimli. He gets some armor that's too long, a bit of comic relief. Then we get this arrival of Haldir from Lothlorien, which is not in the book. There's no elves that arrive at Helm's Deep in the text, but it's cool. So they arrive at the last minute and they're welcome, and the cool silent elves, and they all move in unison, and they're these wonderful archers. And then we start, and there's this wonderful waiting, and the rain starts. Wonderful detail. And he just, Jackson really just kind of waits it out. He just lets you kind of get ready and get set. There's a creaking of shields, and then the marching feet, and the whole Uruk-hai horde comes. Incredible, marching towards the wall. There's another comic relief where Gimli's too short and he can't see over the parapet. I mean, when the Uruk-hai is coming towards that wall, man, it's just like you grab your popcorn and you're like, whoa, man, this is going to be nuts, What I think they do in this battle, and I'll keep narrating as I go, is that the editing, I know what's going on. I know where everything is. There's the Hornburg, there's this long ramp that leads up to the right side, and then there's the whole full-on gate with the culvert, and then there's the keep behind it. So, I've got a sense of direction and scope and scale. I know where everything is. I get a sense of, when you show me what's going on in this battle, I could, before some character has to narrate, "The battle goes ill," or some kind of BS, I already know how it's going because I kind of know the layout of the place because you've shown it to me and it's consistent. And the long shots on the side of things are just really, really epic. It's one of the best battle scenes that's ever been filmed in cinema. I mean, really beautiful. So the orcs wait, and we see their breath exhaling as if it's cold, you know, wonderful detail. They start slamming their spears down. One shaky old man on the wall loses an arrow, and one single orc gets shot and falls down, and then the attack happens. And first, we get this volley of arrows coming up and over the walls and from the walls, continually felling them as they approach. And then the orcs have these wonderful, big, meaty crossbows, which they retaliate with, and, you know, people on the gate start falling. And then they do this thing where, you know, the siege ladders, they're all connected like at the base to some sort of round thing. I think they're kind of jutted into like a series of logs. As that bottom piece is turning, the ladders start flipping up on the walls one after the other in succession. It's just an incredible thing to see. And, you know, the orcs scurry up, and then we're seeing very clearly how they're getting up on the walls and the battle that's happening now on the top of the wall. And they take right from the book the counting battle between Legolas and Gimli, where they're counting how many are killed. And it's, you know, they're kind of shouldering now both the kind of the comic relief throughout this horrific attack. We get what's called a turtle, which is when I think the Romans may have invented it or something similar, where, you know, a group of men with shields form this structure where the shields up top and shields to all the sides are just basically like a turtle, and they're slowly moving up the side ramp. And at the same time, we're seeing that these chunks of explosive gunpowder are being stacked inside the culvert, so they're kind of preparing. As we see the turtle on the side ramp, we see something in the midst of it. We don't really know what it is, and then it's revealed that there's a group of orcs holding a battering ram, and through the turtle being protected, they get right up to the gate and start slamming on it, which is wonderfully shot. And then one of the coolest things I've seen is this berserker run towards the explosives that have been stacked in the culvert. And again, to me, this is Jackson in his horror movie thing. This orc has been painted up with all these symbols and paint, and he's just like screaming and running full tilt with this huge torch in his hand towards the culvert. And it's so realistic and gross at the same time. You know, the orc is just so groupy looking, but he's very powerful and evil and crazy looking. So he's heading towards the culvert, and Aragorn sees him, and they try to bring him down, and they fail. So he leaps into the culvert, touches off the gunpowder, which, of course, completely blows the wall apart. And the camera tracks huge chunks of the wall as they're blown up and around, and when they land back in the main rank of the orcs, how they crush and destroy orcs, which they do, but they do this later during the Battle of the Pelennor Fields when huge chunks of masonry are coming from Minas Tirith and the squashing, you know, orcs. It's a very similar thing. So very, very realistic, very cool to watch. You know, the detail in terms of what they're tracking in these battles also is something that really makes it very exciting and engaging to watch. Then, okay, so the orcs are pouring through the gap, and then we have Legolas on his shield, you know, like surfing down the stairs with his arrows, which every once in a while, the Legolas stuff, like they do a lot of really cool quasi-realistic battle stuff, and then Legolas swings into the picture and does these ridiculous feats of derring do. You know when he brings down the elephant in Return of the King, like you go with it, but it's a cut above like what they're doing really well. You know, like if there was too much of the Legolas stuff, I think these battles would be fluff. But there's so much realism that I can stomach like a Legolas moment here and there, and how realistic and kind of Indiana Jonesy they are, you know what I mean? And so it's fine, but I'm glad there's not too many of them. So now the battle goes ill, and we see the slow fallback to the Hornburg and the death of Haldir. You know, when the elves die, it's a big deal because you're really cutting down what might be an eternal being's life. And then we cut to the tower where there's this furious fighting in close quarters, and we have this moment where on the side where they're battering, trying to batter the doors down, Aragorn and Gimli kind of go out to the side to flank them, which is a cool move just to see it. Like we see exactly what they're doing and how they're flanking them, which again makes it a very interesting battle to watch, because I think the problem with epic battles is if little mini battles that have dramatic arcs are not scripted within the larger battle, it becomes a very boring thing to watch. It's just one more epic thing after the other. With this battle, the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, which comes in Return of the King, Jackson's very smart. And I think he also takes this from Tolkien, where they mini battle dramas are scripted within the larger battle. So you're in an epic battle, but you're really what you can only really take in the dramatics of like a skirmish or one moment. And if it's just a succession of moments of people fighting and stabbing each other, as a viewer, you just kind of, after a while, you're just like, where's this going and where's the shape of it? But because they have, you know, the storming of the ladders, the destruction of the wall, the turtle in the side gate, all these little mini moments that have drama in them, we follow them through. And before you know it, you're 10, 15, 20 minutes into an epic battle, but you've been following the small dramatic moments through, which constantly makes it, first of all, novel, using different weapons and different tactics over and over again. And as well as just, you know, shifting from one thing to the next, there are dramatic stakes in these individual moments because there are small tasks that have to be performed. They have to break up the orcs, you know, on the one side, and they have to try to shoot down the berserker. There are these moments that will either succeed or fail, which lead into the larger battle, but the larger battle is too big to follow emotionally. Jackson figured this out, and it makes his battle sequences really fun to watch. Besides the fact that the editing is so great that I always know where I am. You know, when I'm up on the walls or when I'm down with the orcs or now through the gates or on the side, I always know where in Helm's Deep I am and what I'm watching, which adds to the stakes to me of like, if these people lose this battle in this small area, what that's going to mean and in terms of like, you know, have they fallen back from this place and so on and so forth. So I can see all that. And to me, that's a really testament to the editing. I can't imagine how many hours of footage they had to go through to edit this down, even the extended version, you know, which I don't think they cut too much out. I think the extended version, theatrical version, in terms of the battle sequence, I think it's pretty close to what they had. So just wonderful editing. Now yet another novel thing happens where they've busted through the gate, and now, you know, what's left is the very top of the keep. And so they have these massively tall ladders, and we see how they're raised. They shoot these huge sort of grappling hooks all the way up to the top of these sort of crenellated towers, and they hold. And then from that, they pull these two massive siege towers up. And when as they're coming up, orcs are jumping on them. It's very much like a, you know, just soldiers in battle kind of doing what they're supposed to do. As the ladders are going up, we see orcs jumping on. And so the towers are full of orcs. It's not like the ladders go up naked and they have to start from the bottom. There are orcs already at the top that are being pulled up. So it's beautiful. And a wonderful tactile moment, the ladders get to the top of the crenellated tower. These two metal sort of hooks to hold it there flop over. And we just hear the clanking, you know, the Foley work. It's really beautifully done. During all this, we're back with Entmoot, and we get, you know, how Merry and Pippin are kind of going to, it's really Merry that sets things off, where Pippin wants to go home, and Merry's sort of like, you know, Pip, there isn't going to be any home. If this war is lost, like, everything goes, and they realize they have to fight, and they do their best with the Ents up until the very last, and the Ents refuse. They're like, you know, this is not our war. And because, I like this, because the Hobbits have chosen to be taken to Isengard and not back to the Shire, Treebeard is able to come into that part of Fangorn and see what Saruman has done. And because of that, it finally cuts through all of the bureaucracy of the Ents. He sounds this huge scream, you know, he makes this big sound, and the whole forest comes alive and basically attacks. And we get the last march of the Ents, which again is done in wonderful widescreen. From the side, we see them sort of emerging out of the wood in all these different shapes and sizes and descending down into Isengard. It's a beautiful scene. And what I like about the Ents, especially in this moment, is, and I think this is exactly what Tolkien intended, is they're like these curmudgeonly characters on one hand, but at the other hand, they're kind of scary and ridiculously strong and powerful. And I think Jackson definitely captures both sides of them. So now we flip back to Frodo and Faramir and at Osgiliath, which is now under attack. And we get this, the end of this film, we start to get the kind of really monotone gray. A friend of mine mentioned that he enjoyed Fellowship the most because of the varied color in Fellowship. You know, you're going through different landscapes, which are different colors, and Rivendell is beautiful and Lothlorien. But the latter two films are really steeped in black and gray. I mean, they're almost like black and white films until the very end of Return of the King. So this is our first kind of glimpse of, you know, I read somewhere a movie critic had said that, you know, this was taken from like a Burne Jones painting. And if you look at, I think Burne Jones is an English painter. If you Google Burne Jones, and that's Burne-Jones, you'll see some of his paintings and the similarities to Osgiliath and, you know, some of the latter battles. Really neat. So we're back at Helm's Deep at the very last battle. The orcs are at the last door. And there was this conversation that Gandalf had with Aragorn before they left Edoras about, look for me on the third day, look to the east. And now we hear a ghost of that voiceover from Gandalf. And I think that's a mistake, because why remind me that they're going to be saved, but that, you know, basically the cavalry is going to come, you know, no pun intended, right? I don't think that should be there. Like, don't remind me that the day is about to be saved. You've done so much to get me invested in this battle, and I'm already scared to death and that they're going to die. And I've forgotten, you know, I think the magic of movies sometimes is that they're so powerful that they allow us to forget what we really kind of know, right? That certain people are going to survive and that certain things are not going to happen. But movies can be so good, and that's why they're such an amazing art form, is that even though we kind of know certain things that are going to happen in certain kinds of movies, if a movie is powerful enough, we forget for a while. And I feel like this voiceover from Gandalf is sort of like, hey, by the way, you know, don't be too frightened because the cavalry's coming. And it's like, ah, just let it come, you know? They blow the horn of Helm Hammerhand, which is this beautifully designed horn. We see one of the Rohan soldiers blow it, and it's the entire length of this tower, this massive horn. Unfortunately, they cut back at this moment to the regular soundtrack, because Aragorn basically... Now it's Aragorn's turn to inspire Theoden. He's like, look, ride out with me. And of course he knows that Gandalf is coming, or was supposed to come. Ride out with me, let's meet them. Because at this point, Theoden is like, you know, so much hate. How can anyone stand so much hate? And Aragorn sort of brings him back to his feet. Like, ride out with me, let's make an end of this spectacularly. Let's go for it. When they ride out, I wanted just the horn to continue to blow with no music and allow them to just battle under the sound of that horn for a while. But they cut it quick, and we get more of the triumphant soundtrack, which in a weird way undercuts the cavalry coming, because, you know, we're not really seeing them battling so difficult. I feel like I wanted to see them completely overmatched and like fighting for their lives by the time Gandalf comes. But they kind of do it very quickly, and Gandalf arrives with Eomer and his troop, and Gandalf, you know, at the front lines. I don't think that's right. Like, he's not a frontline warrior, but whatever. You know, he leads the charge. The cavalry comes and they're saved, and it's great. You know, in the book, Eomer's fighting with them the whole time, and they're saved by Erkenbrand, who's the leader who's out and about, and there's no exile or any of that crap. That was kind of made up for the movie. But I think it's smart, because there's not much room for Eomer to do much during the battle for Helm's Deep. He doesn't have a role, so why not have him come in as the cavalry at the end? So again, very smart choice. Then we cut and we witness the attack of the Ents on Orthanc. And again, the continued novelty, Jackson just understands that Tolkien did too, except he wrote the books in these huge chunks where you didn't cut away for long periods of time. But Jackson smashes them all together because he knows how much modern movie going we love to continually cut back and forth between things and continue to refresh the eye with something new, something new, something new. So it just works so well. And now we get this cut to Orthanc, which is amazing. We witness the attack of the Ents, which is incredibly epic. And the release of the river as they knock the dam down. It's just, woo, what a climax. It's a better climax of the battles than the ride of the horses, you know, of the cavalry. For whatever reason, there's just something epic about watching the Ents kind of go apeshit on Isengard. And now we cut back to Osgiliath, and we see this wonderful sequence of Frodo being called by the Nazgul. And he walks slowly to expose himself on this bridge, and this thing arrives, you know, on its creature, on this dragon, these winged dragons that they fly. And it swoops down to take him, but Sam dives and takes him down. And then Frodo flips on Sam and pulls Sting on him. And it's his moment where we think he's going to kill Sam. Then he drops the sword and recovers. And, you know, Faramir's witnessing all this, you know, just after hearing about how Boromir died and watching, you know, Frodo turn on Sam. So he's getting a full dose of, like, ring-itis, as it were. And then Sam has this last speech, which is way didactic, where he's talking about, you know, in those stories, it's the times when you go on and all this kind of crap. And it's like, whatever, just let's, you know, skip it. There's this moment where Faramir has shown his quality, and they turn the line on itself where it's like he has shown his real quality, not shown his quality to his father and gain his father's love, but he's passed his ring test. You know, like Boromir failed the test, Galadriel passed, Gandalf passed, Bilbo passed, Faramir passed. You know, there's like the test of the ring, which is a test of character, you know, and some people fail it and some people pass it. And Faramir has just passed the test, and he's going to allow Frodo and Sam to go unmolested. So then we cut back to Helm's Deep, and I think this is only in the extended edition where we see the Huorns and the Orcs. In the books, when the battle turns, the orcs flee back towards Isengard, but Fanghorn has basically come out and blocked the pass, and the orcs disappear into the trees, and they never come out. And so they do that here, which is neat. So all the remaining orcs are basically disposed of. And there's a wonderful scene of Merry and Pippin finding the storehouse, and Isengard kind of flotsam and jetsam the chapter, as it were, and they find the pipeweed and all the food, which is really great. So we cut away, and then the very last bit is us watching Sméagol and Gollum plan the betrayal of Frodo and Sam to, you know, right now we don't know anything, but we hear the words, her, she'll take care of it. Like, because in some sense, Gollum has promised, he's sworn on the precious not to harm, you know, the hobbits. So he's figuring he'll just lead them to Shelob, who will do the job for him. And then, you know, he'll just pick through the spoils, the ring will be his. So we see that back and forth. And again, it's such a wonderful character. So Andy Serkis, just with the voice and the facial movements, just really wonderful, very believable, and it's really setting the stage for Return of the King. And then we are out. So we're going to move on from here. In the next episode, we're going to start the Return of the King. So see you next time.